It all started with the story of Stephen Gallick, a once successful Florida business owner who wound up beaten to death in a prison van that was supposed to take him to see a judge in Ohio. The van was operated by a private company called Prisoner Transportation Services of America. Marshall Project reporters Eli Hager and Alicia Santo got a tip on Gallick's death from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It led them on a 9-month investigation of the private prison van industry. The reporters found that Gallick was not alone. In the last 16 years, a dozen prisoners had died on the vans, and a dozen more suffered injuries to their necks, skulls, and spines. They also found evidence of some 60 escapes. The story was ultimately published 2 weeks ago in the New York Times. It has since made a big impact. Last week, Attorney General Loretta Lynch told Congress her office would investigate federal oversight of the industry. Today, Eli and Alicia are here to talk about the reporting on the ProPublica podcast. Eli, Alicia, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's start off by talking a little bit about some of the earlier stages of your foray into this world before you found any of this stuff. So what led you to report on prison transportation to begin with?
Well, we got a tip from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, actually. They had heard from a lawyer in Stephen Gallick's case. He was representing Stephen Gallick's family. And they passed the tip on to us because we had done work with them on a previous story.
And who's Stephen Gallick?
He's someone who died under somewhat mysterious circumstances on a prisoner transportation services van in 2012. And his family was bringing a lawsuit. Anyway, they passed that story on to us, and we were looking into Stephen Gallick's case. We got as much as we could on Stephen Gallick's case, but in the process realized that there were so many other lawsuits against this one company, PTS. So we decided there's maybe something there, and after that, we pulled together as large a list of companies as we could that did this, and we just ran them all for lawsuits and went from there.
So Stephen Gallick, tell me just a little bit more about him. I mean, much of your reporting focuses on his journey, at least the beginning at the end of the story. Who is he? And tell me a little bit more about what you came to find out about his situation.
Right. He was a father of three. He formerly owned a home remodeling business. He was a successful middle-class businessman, but he had a bit of a downfall. He had a divorce. He had to move to Florida. He had a painkiller addiction at one point and suffered from extreme anxiety. Anyway, he got behind on his child support, and an arrest went out from Ohio, where he used to live. At one point, he had an interaction with police in Florida, and they saw this warrant in Ohio. And essentially, Ohio hired this private company, PTS, to go pick him up in Florida and drive him to Ohio. So he got on the van after some days at the local jail there, and it was extremely hot. It was in the 90s in late July. He got on the van. They were going to be on the van for 3-4 days. And after a day, he just started to lose it a little bit. He had anxiety. He became delusional. He was saying some goofy things. And the net effect of this was that he was just keeping everybody up, because you have to understand, on these vans, there's 12 of them basically crammed next to each other. They have to sit upright for days on end. They can't lie down to sleep. There's no ventilation, little air conditioning. So everybody's just getting angry at him because he's being so loud and annoying. He's poking people and saying weird things. And at one point, according to two of the prisoners, the one driver of the van pulled over, took Stephen Gallick out, thrust him in the middle between the other prisoners, and said, "Only body shots, have at him," basically suggesting that they beat him to get him to shut up. And 70 miles later, after they had crossed into Tennessee, his body was found. There was blood, urine, and vomit on the van. He had a broken rib. He had chipped tooth, cuts all over his face, bruises on his body, and he was dead. But the homicide investigation lasted less than 24 hours, and the van just went on its way with all the passengers on board, and no one was ever re-interviewed.
What'd you find out about the nature of that investigation?
Well, one of the interesting things is that these vans are crossing jurisdictional boundaries. like every hour because they're in motion. So in that case, the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation came in to investigate the death, but they decided within about 8 hours that if there was a crime, it probably happened in Georgia. So they called the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. They said, this is probably your case. Georgia Bureau of Investigation never followed up, in part because the autopsy much later came back undetermined cause of death. So this problem of different jurisdictions not knowing who to investigate and saying somebody else should investigate, that's something that we saw a lot. And the Ohio, the county asking for him to be brought to them, they didn't take responsibility because he wasn't yet in their custody. Florida had sent him, but he was out of their custody. So there's like a jurisdictional problem that we saw a lot.
It's fascinating that because the transportation of these prisoners encompasses so many states, it makes it really difficult for the authorities to, I guess, properly investigate because it requires some interstate cooperation. Alicia, did you find that happen in any of the other cases that you'd looked at?
It's something that just comes up again and again in the sense that, and even when we were looking at it ourselves as reporters, I think it becomes difficult to pinpoint one person or one agency to blame. For example, in many of the cases where medical neglect was a big part of what had contributed to the person's death or injury, what we a lot of times found is that the person had spent a significant amount of time sitting in a jail somewhere waiting for the transportation company to come and pick them up. And so the allegations weren't only directed at the transportation company. Oftentimes they were also receiving quite inadequate medical care while they were waiting in the jail. So I think that this compounds the confusion for an investigator, and it makes it easier for jurisdictions to kind of hand it off for it not being their problem. Like, if you're the requesting agency, well, you didn't cause all these conditions to happen. You just paid a provider to bring the person back. If you're the place that housed the person, well, it wasn't even your inmate, technically, that you were just holding them for somebody else. And then the company is kind of the in-between here. And that Eli was saying, it becomes confusing when you're crossing so many different state lines and different boundaries, and it's also so unclear what happens because this is like a moving vehicle, and you know the only people that see it are the people that are on there. You know, there's no cameras or anything of that sort to monitor
right.
What
it sounds like
happens.
That would make the reporting really challenging too, with all of these different actors from whom you'd have to get information and whom you'd have to ask questions of. How did it go from Stephen Gallick's case to what sounds like a pretty voluminous array of cases? Get into some of the nitty-gritty of how you're able to collect all of that stuff.
We had a few different methods. So we used Pacer and Westlaw to pull as many lawsuits as we could and organize the allegations of the lawsuit into different kinds of categories of abuse and neglect occurring. Another aspect of our story was escapes and crashes. Our research on those really kind of speaks to the importance of local news reporting because, you know, we used a lot of news searches to identify these escapes and these crashes that had happened all over the country, and like little newspapers would write about them. But there wasn't anybody that had really connected the dots in terms of like these escapes and crashes were happening all over the place. It was just being written about in little news blurbs. And so that was another really big aspect of our reporting was using those initial news reports and then following up, getting the accident report from the actual agency to find out, for example, what time it occurred and if people were in seatbelts. And then for the escapes, like following up and calling the local law enforcement agency that was in charge of basically going on a manhunt for a person that just happened to be crossing through in one of these private vans and finding out from them, you know, did they seek reimbursement from the company, which a lot of them did and never got any reimbursement. So I'd say those were a couple of ways that we went at it.
And you both write about how a lot of what you found comes down to the economy of prison transportation, that these companies are forced in a way to provide this service as cheaply as possible. How does the payment structure work and what are the practical implications of it?
The reason why it seems more cost-effective to local jurisdictions that hire these companies is because if you're like a local sheriff in rural Utah or something and you find out that somebody that you want on an arrest warrant has been located all the way in Florida, the options that face you are either to send one of your deputies on this long excursion there and back just to get one person, which is very expensive. You pay the person a lot of overtime. You waste one of your personnel. Or you can just go online and hire one of these companies, and they make it much more cost effective because they're essentially doing a one-way delivery instead of a two-way there and back adventure just to get one person. So, but then they're paid per prisoner per mile. So that incentivizes them, first of all, to pack the vans with as many people as possible as they go on these journeys around the country picking people up. And it also incentivizes them to drive through the night at high speeds for as many days as possible to just keep racking up those miles. So those were some of the things we discovered in terms of the economics of this.
Right. And one thing that struck me in the story was the responses that you got from the companies. Many of them, it sounded like, at least the officials that still work with these companies, were saying that these lawsuits came as a result of false allegations by prisoners. And they seemed to be in sort of a state of almost like disbelief that they were doing anything wrong or that it was all kind of justifiable given the circumstances. Were you surprised by that? Or what did it feel like to hear that back from them?
Yeah, I don't know if I would say I was surprised. I didn't have, personally, like I didn't have an expectation. We didn't really know what to expect in terms of their response to us. It's kind of like a typical response in the sense of like, we're getting people who are very sick. Sometimes we're not given medical information. And also, as you always hear when you're a criminal justice reporter, well, the inmates are lying. And it's not that people who are incarcerated don't lie, but it's just such a go-to situation. And that was why actually speaking to the guards was such an important aspect of the reporting, because we did have a hard time actually getting the companies to engage with us, particularly when they realized how much we knew about them. We came to really rely on a lot of employees who we spoke to who were actually quite open, which is also comparatively unusual in the sense that it's usually more difficult to get law enforcement to speak with you so openly. But a lot of these former employees and even current employees felt that it was morally wrong what was going on. And so they were open to talking about it. That was a really big help for us in figuring out beyond like records and stuff from a human element, like what is this actually like of a day to day?
Yeah, it seems like you were able to speak to quite a few of them. How were you able to so successfully gain their trust?
It was a surprising number of extradition agents on LinkedIn. That was our main strategy. We also used Facebook. And then once you get one on your side talking to you, they introduce you to all their friends who are also working for the company, that kind of thing. So that was our spidering out strategy to talk to guards. I think what Alicia said is exactly right in terms of why did they trust us or how do we get them to trust us. It basically came more quickly than we thought it would because they thought they were put in a really unfair position by a lot of these companies. A lot of them had only been working for the companies for 1 or 2 years. The turnover is very high. They weren't paid very well. They were told they had to drive at all hours of the night for days and days and days and days. They weren't given much training. Most of them told us maybe 2-3 days, here's how you put on handcuffs, here's how you spray pepper spray, here's our paperwork, and then they put them on the road with all these sometimes violent prisoners in the back. So all of these circumstances they thought were unfair and sometimes inhumane, and they resented that, a lot of them, and that was why they talked to us.
Wow. 2 or 3 days of training, and then you're put on the road with a van full of prisoners. It's a pretty wild operation, isn't it? It's the kind of thing that just seems to come up again and again in criminal justice stories these days. I mean, we just did one 2 weeks ago with Shane Bauer on the Corrections Corporation of America training prison guards for, you know, a handful of days before sending them in to watch prisoners. I'm curious if there was like a guard or a moment in particular with a certain source who really helped you guys unlock this thing. Was there a conversation that stands out that you can tell us about?
Yeah, one does for me, definitely. I'm sure Eli's thinking of the same one. But we interviewed this one guard. We had found some people who had died on these vans from a lawsuit and from two lawsuits and from a news story. So we were aware of three people who had died. And then I was interviewing a guard, and he mentioned that there had been a recent death, very recently, and he knew only the county. But he said that it had happened, and we followed up on it, and it did actually happen. And that, I felt, was a pretty big moment in the sense that it was a recent death. They kind of had a new takeover of the company, and so we were thinking, like, maybe they've improved a lot. But when we found out about the fourth death, that was just in January, I think that was a big moment in the reporting because we realized, nope, they're still doing it this way and there's still people dying.
How'd you manage to nail that particular death down?
There was a couple of really interesting things about that. I was thinking of the same one. First of all, the guard that told us did not actually work for PTS, the company that the death happened on one of its vans. He worked for a different company, but he happened to be at the same jail at the same time when they found this dead body who had just come off of PTS.
Just by happenstance.
Just by total
there.
Happenstance, he happened to be there, and he said, it was in this county. I know it happened in January. I saw it. We called the sheriff's office there who runs the jail in that county, and we said, basically, we heard there was a death. We didn't know it much more than that. And they were, very vague with us at first. I think in part because they have an ongoing relationship with PTS. They're one of PTS's hubs. PTS is stopping through there all the time, so they weren't necessarily going to divulge much to us right away. But we eventually found the coroner in the county who was a real chatty Cathy, and he just wanted to tell us about the death, and he said that it had been from a treatable ulcer, that if they had stopped for medical care, he would have been fine. And so then we got the name, and then we were able to go back to the sheriff's department and get their file on the case.
Yeah, that's one of those exciting breakthrough moments that we all live for as reporters. How did the two of you feel that day upon discovering it?
Yeah, it's really sad because then you realize another person lost their life in this horrific way. You feel good because now you know you're going to be able to expose it. And finding it out and being able to get it in the story because it came later on actually in the reporting. I'm just happy for the family that we were able to get it out there because they wanted people to know what had happened to their family member. And so the feeling of maybe a little bit of justice for this person, and at least that his death wasn't just completely silent and no one ever knowing how it had happened.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of those dueling emotions that we all deal with as reporters covering grim subjects day in and day out. So what about roadblocks? I'd imagine getting stuff out of a lot of these agencies, like sheriff's office, as you were saying, was being really vague. Was it hard to get the records that you needed that formed the underpinnings of this story? Anything that was particularly difficult, any one agency or FOIA process that thwarted you?
Well, the federal records that we were asking for from the Department of Transportation did take a very long time to come back, as federal records often do. We had compiled a list of the companies that do this, and we essentially asked the DOT to give us everything that they had ever done to those companies, audits, compliance reviews, things like that, because the DOT is supposed to check the driving logs to make sure they're not on the road for too many hours in a row, check vehicle maintenance records, check driver health and backgrounds. So they're supposed to do that kind of vehicle and driver safety stuff the same way they do for buses and trucks and things like that. But it was our sense that they really didn't do much of that. And that bore out once we got the records. They do it very infrequently. They didn't audit PTS for a period of 5 years at one point. They do it only reactively when there's some sort of fatal crash. They come in and check the records, and they even give the companies notice before they're going to come in and check their records. So it all bore out. But long story short, that did take a while. But Alicia did a really great job. She was pestering them on a very regular basis to get those.
So Alicia, take us into that pestering process a little bit. I know that's always kind of a crucial, important move for all of us here, especially in dealing with federal agencies. So how did you make it work?
Well, I always joke around that I'm a professional pest, but I guess we all are, right? I mean, and to me, when it comes to records requests, if you don't remind them of your existence, you can just pretty much assume that you've been forgotten. So I do that with all records requests, though. I'll just write once a week and ask where it is, or I'll call, too, just to be more of a human and to just say, I really need these, anything you can do. Because honestly, I don't imagine it's anyone sitting there at DOT let's hide these from her. I think it's just more of a sheer fact that they had hundreds of requests. They told me that they kind of bumped us up in the line, which was really nice of them. A lot of people requesting from DOT. So I actually found them to be, when you deal with requests as much as we do and have as much difficulties, that they were actually cooperative in that they did get them to us in an amount of time in which we could actually use them. So that was helpful.
How'd you know you had everything nailed down? I mean, was there a point at which you kind of said, I think we've got enough here, a critical mass of information to do this story and start writing? And what were those discussions like? When did they happen?
We have created all these databases, and they had become basically complete. And so we were ready to write. So I think that was a big moment, too, because we had been building and building these databases to analyze each of these different things that we get into in the story. When you rely on news reports, you want to call the agencies yourself. You want to make sure that you have reliable information, because the news report is the tip that there might have been something there, and then you kind of have to report it out. So I would say, like, once we had kind of reported all of those things out, I always felt like we were at a point where we really knew. And you also, and this is classic for a lot of stories, but you come to the point where everyone's telling you the same thing or telling you the same people to talk to. So you feel like you've circled the whole community.
And can you kind of take off real quick what was in each of these databases that you had constructed?
Yeah, we had an initial database that was just like every incident we just dumped everything in there. But then we made a crashes database, and using accident reports and court records and things, we would say what time of day or night did it happen, because we had the impression that a lot of these were happening at 2, 3 a.m. and that lack of sleep may have been involved, and we knew we wanted to make that point in the story. So we had a column for what time did it happen. We had a column for were the inmates seatbelted, because we also knew that it was very common for them to be shackled at their wrists, waist, and ankles but not seatbelted, which kind of turns them into pinballs, unable to brace themselves, and we wanted to be able to make that point. Were they seatbelted or not? We also had columns for was speeding involved and some other things, but we didn't end up using that stuff. And then we had a database of escapes where we had a column for was negligence by the company involved, like did they leave the van unlocked or did they stop at a rest stop, which is usually against policy, or did they not dress the prisoners in brightly colored clothing, which they're supposed to do. And we had a column for was it someone who was facing violent or sex-related charges who escaped, and how long did it take to find the person after he escaped from the van. And then we also had a column for the local law enforcement that hunted this person down. Did they get reimbursed for that manhunt, which is supposed to happen in cases of negligence? But from talking to sheriffs, it rarely happened. So with crashes and escape, we broke them down by that. And then we had other databases with state and federal lawsuits involving sexual abuse, other types of abuse and neglect. So that was kind of the larger universe. And then we also had some other databases, like all 50 states. Had we contacted them? Did they use these prisoner transport companies? Things like that.
Right. No, it's a crucial aspect of the reporting, like you said. You also had a section about efforts toward reform of this system, which one would hope is something that legislators and lawmakers would take seriously. What triggered that effort, and where does it stand now?
Well, in 2000, there was a very high-profile escape. So this whole industry had operated very much under the radar for 10 or 15 years, and lawsuits related to prisoner mistreatment and things like that hadn't got much attention. But the escape of one very notorious prisoner did get a lot of attention. So it was somebody named Kyle Bell, who had molested and murdered an 11-year-old girl in North Dakota, and he was this kind of famous inmate, and he escaped. And there was a lot of negligence involved in the escape. The guards on the van didn't even notice for several hours, and then they didn't notify law enforcement for several hours, and then the guy was missing for several months, and there was a America's Most Wanted episode about it. So it was getting a lot of attention. This was kind of the first moment when this extradition industry had gotten national attention, and somebody who was then a senator in North Dakota sponsored a bill to put some controls on the industry, especially with regard to escapes and preventing escapes. So this bill required that violent prisoners be dressed in colorful clothing. If there is an escape, you notify local law enforcement right away. that there be a certain guard to prisoner ratio to make sure there's not too many prisoners on a van without enough guards, things of that sort. And the bill passed, but in the 16 years since then, it's only been enforced one time. The Department of Justice has only taken one enforcement action of that law, and it was actually another escape that occurred in North Dakota, and that's part of the reason there was a lot of local attention on the escape, so they used this law and fined a company, and the company actually went out of business. But other than that, the law has only been enforced once. Huh.
So it passed after a nationally kind of recognized incident, and there's been very little in the way of enforcement since then. So any feedback yet that would lead you to believe there might be a bolstering of that enforcement process or further legislation?
Well, the senator who sponsored that bill, Senator Byron Dorgan, did reach out to us and was very interested in the article the whole way through. And, you know, he said he'd be speaking with some of his former colleagues and trying to get some attention around this and why hasn't there been enforcement. But I'm not totally sure what will happen and what won't.
I see. Is there a key takeaway that you guys really hope readers will have after going through your story and listening to this podcast?
I'm just excited people know that this exists, because I think that that was one of the biggest things for us, is that it just seemed like a one element of privatization and criminal justice that there was really no attention being paid to it. And it's, you know, it is so invisible because they're on the road, they're driving, and it's not like a facility that you can, like, look at and see. So I think that that's just important in itself, that people realize that this is out there. And then we put out a reporting guide, and, you know, and we're hoping that other reporters will dig into it in their own area. As journalists, we all think, and I'm sure we would all agree, that more attention, more transparency, more light shown on this, then it likely could have an effect. The attention is sustained, and, you know, we continue to just make sure people know that it's being watched.
Well, it's a fabulous story. The reporting is obviously very thorough. You guys left no stone unturned, and you should be commended for it. So I hope it leads to the impact that you want. Thanks so much for coming in to tell us about it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Please tune in next week.